Good evening, and welcome to 360 North's Arts at 360. I'm your host, Scott Burton. Tonight's program is Writer Showcase, an ongoing series that features Alaskan actors reading work by Alaskan writers. Tonight, our writers and actors explore the theme of endurance. Our four short stories and essays take us everywhere from a heated rock climb to the backseat of a Lincoln Continental convertible. Right here on Writer's Showcase. Our first writer is James P. Sweeney. He composed the piece One Hard Day after a climbing accident which left him unable to be out in the mountains, but very capable of putting his adventures and stories into writing. Here he takes us to the scorching cliffs of El Capitan in Yosemite, where he and his climbing partner endure intense heat, dehydration, physical exhaustion, and each other. Our reader is Roblin Gray Davis.
Kevin and I are out of water. Yesterday, the temperature must have been 110. We are two-thirds of the way on our climb up the big rock wall, El Capitan, in Yosemite National Park, and past all the difficult climbing, but we're moving awfully slow. Last night, right after dark, I climbed the Grand Traverse. It's supposed to be the crux. We haven't slept much in 3 days. At about 2, we tried to sleep on this sloping ledge. Every time I'd fall asleep, I'd wake thinking I was sliding off the mountain. We're in the middle of an epic. At first light, I'm ready to climb. We have to reach the top today. I met Kevin in Camp 4. He didn't have any big rock wall experience. Originally, I asked him to climb the south face of Washington Column, which is one of the easiest big walls. But when he was all geared up and ready to go, I told him we were climbing El Cap. The afternoon sun bakes this side of the big stone. Right now, the sky is dark blue and there is a big yellow moon. I cannot see one light down in Yosemite Valley. There's not one thing to tell me we're not the only ones on the planet. I cannot see the Merced River, but I'm so thirsty I'd drink its water even though thousands of people are less than 2 miles upstream. I dread when the sun hits us later today. The climb is named Lurking Fear. There were no ledges on the first 13 pitches. We should have brought a hammock. We climbed all night the first night. 2 nights ago, we both tried to sleep on a ledge less than a foot wide and 6 feet long. We slept with our legs in slings. Kevin talked about backing off yesterday. There's no way I'm backing off now. It's too dangerous. I may never get a chance to climb El Cap again, but I don't know how much longer we can go without water and sleep. We should have brought some lemon drops. It hurts to swallow. I'm leading everything now, I say. Kevin doesn't like it. It took him 5 hours to do one pitch yesterday. This is my fourth wall this summer. The climbing is hard right above the belay. Kevin couldn't pull this move last night, and I use every trick I know to make the move. Then the climbing is easier. I spent the whole summer in the Sierra Nevada mountains of California. I'm lucky to be here. I fell off a cornice last winter in Valdez, Alaska, and took a big ride in an avalanche. I broke my leg. It's my second accident in 5 years. Everyone has something to say to me. They don't understand. They haven't spent one-tenth of time I have in the mountains. What am I doing here? Am I trying to prove myself? Are my motives pure? None of this matters halfway up El Capitan, but these are my thoughts as I climb. I say the Lord's Prayer and Hail Marys, too. This is the easiest pitch yet. At a small ledge, I stop and tell myself, let's go, while I set up the belay. When I'm secure, I holler, off belay! A set of headlights winds up the valley floor. Smoky rays of sunlight paint the tops of the walls. On belay, let's go, I holler. The haul bag is a lot lighter without the water. It must have weighed 90 pounds when we started. We couldn't have carried more water. The bag gets stuck on everything. I use brute force to get it next to me. Kevin is halfway up the pitch. Kevin is from Lake Tahoe. He's a hotshot skier and in a bunch of ski movies. Someday he'll be a great climber, but today he's getting his ass kicked. I give him no mercy. Come on, let's go, let's go! Backing off is not an option. The sun streaks halfway down the walls across the valley as I begin the next pitch. The climbing is dirty, grassy, and harder than our guide says. I do everything I can to move fast. After 150 feet, there's a ledge that stinks like piss. A 5-inch wide crack at the back is stuffed with garbage. I tie myself with carabiners and slings to the stone and yell out, "Off belay!" After some more knots and carabiners, I yell, "On belay!" The sun is nearly to the valley floor. Kevin drank a lot more of the water than I did. Maybe if I get up this climb, I'll quit climbing. "Come on, Kevin, let's go!" The bag is easy to pull. I tie it next to me, then sit down and wait. The stench is unbearable. But if we had water, I'd sleep here right now. Everything's gone wrong on this climb. My headlamp died the first night. I climbed the Grand Traverse with a penlight strapped to the side of my head. Kevin dropped my sleeping bag when we tried to sleep on the little ledge. I've been climbing for 10 years, and it seems I've had more than my share of hard times. Sunlight sweeps the valley floor. I lead 2 more pitches. The climbing is awkward. I have to dig dirt and grass up out of the crack to get protection. The route is not so obvious. The bag is hard to pull. I hear a voice from the speakers on an open-air tour bus. I see the river sparkle between the trees. Kevin wants to lead. The sun is now on us, and I'm sitting on the belay seat with my head on the bag. Kevin is methodic as he re-racks. "Get moving," I rasp. I can't swallow. Not a breath of wind moves across stone. I use my coat as a shield against the sun. Kevin is about 20 feet above, focused on the crack in front of him. "Come on, Kevin, reach up and get moving. We have to top out today. We're being broiled alive. I've only seen it this hot once in Dubai. It was 126 degrees. Suddenly, a whistling sound pierces the wall. It's coming from above, 3 missiles shrieking down the face. I tuck in as close as I can to the wall. First, I think they are rocks, and then I realize they're falcons, and they pass moments apart. I'm always in trouble. I've been in some kind of trouble my whole life. On the last day of school in 8th grade, I got thrown out for something stupid. My father shaved my head and put me on restriction. I ran away to Haight-Ashbury and slept in the bushes of Golden Gate Park, but there were too many hippies, so I hitchhiked to Santa Cruz. Cops were everywhere, arresting anyone hitchhiking. Somehow, I got out of there and thumbed my way here to Yosemite. It was no better. Riots broke out in El Cap Meadows, and the rangers arrested anybody who seemed out of place. I almost got busted, but I hiked out of the valley and headed for Tulum. I camped out in the open that night, and a bear grabbed my pack and stole all my food. I hiked the rest of the way to Tulum with nothing to eat. Now the sun is directly on us, and I'm nodding off. The rope barely moves, and I can't see Kevin, and I can't yell because of my throat. After a while, the rope quits moving, and I barely hear "off belay." I'm ready to go when he croaks "on belay." I stay with a bag and help it along. I don't know if it's lack of sleep or the heat, but there's a fog, and I only concentrate on being safe. Nothing else really matters. The rock below the belay stance is coated with dry piss. It's another uncomfortable belay. Kevin's eyes are slits and his lips are white. He still wants to lead. Let's go, get moving. The next pitch is utterly awful crack climbing, and then we're on a big ledge with a deep cave. It's called Thanksgiving Ledge. This is the hottest place I've ever been. The sun shines right inside, and it is stinking hell. The ledge stretches a 1/4 mile across the whole west face. 50 empty plastic water bottles and other garbage is strewn about. Climbers are pigs. We add our empties to the pile, and Kevin checks every bottle for water. There's not one drop. Kevin wants to crawl into the shade in the back of the cave and take a break. I tell him only for a minute. He's back in there, hunched over a rock. I ask him, "Aren't you worried about rattlesnakes?" "F*** you, Sweeney. You're an a-hole. I just wanted a little break." "Let's go," I tell him. We cached 3 bottles of water and some food at the top. I'm not stopping until we get there. "Sweeney, you're an a-hole." We traverse 80 feet on Thanksgiving Ledge, and Kevin leads the next pitch. Our guide says we're done with the difficult climbing, but we can't see the top. The sun is a golden fireball. The temperature cools. I'm leading now. We are on slabs of low-angle stone. I pray and promise God I'll be better if he lets me off this mountain. I try the Virgin Mother, too, but doubt she'd listen to me. The climbing is easy, but there is little protection. There's a hard spot, and if I fall, I'd fall 200 feet. I keep it together and feel strong. The sunset is orange, red, and after a while, pink. Venus and Mars are out. The top is nowhere in sight. We climb another pitch, and it's dark. We decide we are going to leave the haul bag, some gear, and one of our ropes here. We can come back in the morning and get the gear. We've been 30 hours without water. I commandeer Kevin's headlamp and tell him I'm leading. Let's go. Let's go. He's going to wear the bag with a sleeping bag and our coats in it. I head up into the dark, moving fast, but El Capitan feels like it will never end. There's a giant loose flake. When I tap it, it rings hollow. I'm scared it will fall and crush Kevin. If I fall now, I'd fall 300 feet before the rope caught me. I belay from a small tree and watch the stars. Moonlight takes over the landscape. There's faint darting lights on ribbon falls. other climbers' headlamps, I think. When Kevin is next to me, I say, off belay. Kevin says, let's go, as my headlamp tunnels a path up the slab. I'm climbing as fast as I can. I can stick to anything. We need to get to our cache tonight. We need water. At the next belay, I watch two satellites traverse the sky. I hear a jet. The moonlight fills the valley with long shadows from the giant walls. Kevin is next to me. I'm moving within a couple of minutes. Two more pitches and we could probably unrope, but we stay tied in because of the dark. I'm running. Two pine cones sit on a ledge. What if someone found our cache and stole it? What if we can't find the water? As I roll over the top, I see the full moon. I stack the rope in a pile. Kevin's a penlight in the dark, and then he's next to me. I shine my light in his face. Give me my headlamp, Kevin says. I'm coiling the rope. Then we're traversing left through bushes with a few trees. Kevin leads. There's plenty of light with a full moon. I follow Kevin for 5 minutes, wondering if we will find our cache. Did someone else get it? Kevin's digging around at the base of some bushes. I got it, he says. The blue stuff sack is in his hands. He fumbles with a drawstring, and then he has a plastic bottle of water in his hands.
In what could have been written as a companion piece to James P. Sweeney's, our next story by Martha Amore follows a new mom who endures waiting for her partner to return from a climb, the seemingly endless demands of her 5-month-old baby, and loneliness. This story, called Half Hitch, is read in abridged form by Donnie Gott.
Yesterday, I came across one of Jack's climbing ropes. In between nursing the baby and pacing the house with her, I spent pointless hours tying off knots, one after the other, like worry beads. Half hitch, bowline, figure eight. I can't stop picturing him, bound for Patagonia, as he disappeared through the flash of the airport doors, the bright neon colors of his backpack, passport and ticket in hand, how he turned once and smiled, and then he was gone. I hear Stella cry. The weak northern sun won't rise for hours, but I take her downstairs to nurse her by the big window in the darkened living room. Jack and I have never lived in a real house like this before. When it was just the two of us, we lived in our truck, or rented bare-bones cabins, the kind without water or electricity, perched halfway up a mountain. We were always on the move. But in Alaska, I discovered I was pregnant. We headed to the nearest city for Stella's birth and ended up digging in. Buying a house. I like it here more than I thought I would, the urban trails and mountain views and coffee shops. But it's the wilderness that brought us to Alaska, and now we're one step removed from it. Maybe this is why I haven't done a thing to make our house a home in the 4 months we've lived here. Beige carpets, egg white walls, speckled gray cabinets in the kitchen and bathrooms. The colors are so bland, I feel like I'm being erased. I sit on the milk crate that serves as our coffee table and hold Stella up to the picture window to look out at the new snow. The entire neighborhood lies buried beneath it. She's mesmerized. My neighbor Tom is heaving shovels full after shovels full of his out of his walkway, oblivious to us. The day I met him, I introduced myself as a housewife, just to try it on, to feel the effect of the suburban horror. I thought he was joking when he said he was in the same trade, but it's true. He owns a construction company, and since the weather turned cold, he's been home every day, puttering in the garage or working on his truck or just standing in his driveway, looking thoughtfully at his house, waiting for his wife and daughters to come home. Even up north, where the winter days are short, there's still plenty of time to wade through. To the east, a reddish glow is just barely touching the highest peaks. Flame-colored streaks appear and spread throughout the darkened sky, slicing it open just above the ridgelines. The upper snowfields are catching the light now, warming to shades of rose and tangerine. I feel the familiar surge in my chest, a primal thing, a call and response. I try to content myself by soaking in the beauty of it all. I move to the other window, Stella riding on my hip. These sunrises are not rare up here on a clear winter day, and yet the sight of them always hits me like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, one that is slipping away. Soon the sun will be up, and even though I've watched the whole thing, I'll be left with the feeling that I've somehow missed it all. Tom pauses, unzips his down jacket, takes off his hat, and runs his hands through tufts of black and silver hair. I think about yelling out the door at him, but just then he turns toward the mountains and drops his shovel. A sense of quiet fills me. We watch, motionless, until the peaks turn white and the sky blue. Jack says he'll never get used to this neighborhood, to living so close to the next house that you could lean out the window and touch it, but this morning I feel a comfort in this closeness. In the garage, I strap Stella to the car seat, lashed to the big orange mountaineering sled, and pull her outside into the frigid air. It smells like pine trees and wood smoke and feels good against my skin like a splash of water. "Cold enough for you?" Tom asks. "Just about," I say. "Beautiful snow." "It is." I look up into the still white branches of a birch tree in his front yard, unable to think of anything else to say. "But I'm tired of the cold," he says. "Every winter I ask myself the same thing. Why am I still up north complaining about the cold? If we were smart, we'd head for Hawaii." "If we were smart, we'd already be there," I say. I've never been to Hawaii, never wanted to go, but now that I've said it, I can't help but imagine lying on the beach, warm winds on my skin, and Stella rolling naked in the sand. Tom scoops up a shovel full of snow and holds it at knee level. "Any news from Jack?" "Couple of emails. I won't hear anything else for a while." "When's he due back?" 3 more weeks. He raises his eyebrows and nods slowly. "That's a long haul." After tossing the snow in the growing pile in his yard, he looks down at Stella. "So go easy on your mom," he says. "Please, keep talking. She needs to hear this." He crouches beside her. "Those are some eyes," he says, looking closer. "Holy cow, what are they? Blue? Green?" "Take your pick," I say. Now I'm bending over her, too. They really are something. Clear, blue, but for the touch of brown that rings her pupils. This combination keeps her eye color in constant flux, like the mood ring I wore in college. Jack says she has my eyes, but it isn't true. Mine are just flat blue. "Well," he says, standing up, "let us know if you need anything. It wasn't all that long ago my girls were this age." He smiles down at Stella, resting his hands one over the other on the shovel's handle, rocking it back and forth. Stella whimpers from the sled. The sun is bright, but there's no warmth in it, and there's a steady, icy wind. I know I should start walking. Soon the baby will start howling. The only way to soothe her is nursing, but I don't want to leave yet. I reach down and dip my mitten in the snow, my favorite type, light and airy, but wet enough just barely pack together. I want to roll in this snow, pile it over my legs, throw it in the air, scrub my face with it. When she cracks into a scream, I brush off my mittens and lift the sled rope over my shoulder. "Well," I say. Tom drops down next to her once again. "Hey there," he says, removing a glove and rubbing her cheek while making a sound with his tongue. I can't believe it. She goes silent. Out of fear, no doubt, but at least she's quiet. He smiles at her, deadpans, then smiles once more. I see how this expression has marked him, how the lines on his face, the darting rays from the corner of his eyes, the double curves fencing in his lips, the delicate cuts fanning back through his cheeks were carved by kindness. It occurs to me that if I ever needed to, if there were some kind of emergency, I could leave Stella with him. This isn't something I've worried about, at least not consciously, but I'm suddenly filled with relief. I fight the urge to lay my hand on his shoulder. He nods over to my driveway. "Want me to shovel for you?" "That depends," I say, grinning, unable to stop myself. "What will you charge me?" He laughs, opens his mouth to say something, but just laughs again. Later at night, I think I hear Stella moaning. It's 3 a.m. I sit in bed and listen hard, but there's nothing. I lay staring at the Tibetan prayer flags crisscrossing our bedroom ceiling, squares of dyed cotton stretching out in a color sequence, blue, white, red, green, and yellow. We brought them back from Nepal years ago. It takes me hours to fall back asleep. Every night it's the same. I wake up because I think Stella is crying and then discover it's just a dog barking down the block or a police siren railing or, like tonight, nothing at all. She's 5 months old and still waking 2 or 3 times before morning. I can nurse or rock her back to sleep within 15 minutes, but she leaves me wide-eyed and staring up at the flags. Before the weather turned cold, Jack used to strap her in the snuggly and take her on midnight runs around the neighborhood. It would always put her right to sleep, her cheek pressing against him, her little pink lips suckling the air. It's all the movement, he once said. I shook my head and told him, it's your heartbeat. I held my hand to his chest just above her head. The thudding was so alive under my touch, like Stella quickening in the womb. I loved to wrap my arms around him after these runs. The baby between us no longer felt like an extension of myself as she did during the pregnancy, but an intersection of us both, where the two of us crossed. 2 days later, Tom stops by with a bright red Williams Express mug and a paper sack full of powdered donuts. I glance around the living room, embarrassed by the baby toys and books and dirty dishes strewn about, and by the lack of furniture, the milk crate coffee table. I've been in his house, once, just after we moved into the neighborhood. Bright, airy rooms filled with such heavy furniture, and the kitchen with the red tile floor and big iron pots hanging over the sink, a clock with pictures of northern birds rather than numbers. It all seemed so permanent. Sorry, I say, I should clean up a bit. It's fine, he says. You have more important things to worry about. He takes Stella from me and begins to whisper, whoopsie, as he drops her to the floor, but she's not even smiling. She's staring at him with her unsettling gaze, the one that says she's seen all this before and is not impressed. This kid sure has a lot on her mind, he says. She takes after me. I pull the climbing rope from under the table and start working it through my fingers, feeling for the frayed spot in the middle, the reason Jack left it behind. Is that your answer to knitting? He asks. This one's for you, I say. I make a loop and quickly wind the nylon into a series of twists and then yank the end. I dangle the rope in front of him. Hangman's knot. Your mom has quite a talent, he says, to the top of Stella's head. Really, that's just charming. Okay, I'll do something a little more decorative. He moves onto the floor and watches each twist I make in the rope. Do you miss it? Climbing? My hands slow. His question has caught me off guard. I don't know how to explain it to someone who doesn't climb. Give it a try. I hold the rope in my lap for a moment, rubbing my thumb over the damaged part. Okay. Imagine what you love the most in this world, I say. Got it? Yeah. Well, now imagine it's gone. He nods his head slowly. I'm beginning to get the picture. So what was it? I ask. You don't mind telling me. Oh, mine wasn't an it, he says, shrugging. It's a who. Several of them, actually. I lower my eyes. A tightness claims my chest. I busy myself with completing the knot. It's early evening, and Stella is at her worst, red-faced and screaming in her car seat. The truck won't turn over. I press my forehead against the steering wheel and think, if I could just get to the grocery store for something for dinner, if I could just do this one simple thing. Her cries echo through the cab, bullets of sound, waves ricocheting every which way. I'm breathing fast now, but I can't seem to catch my breath. What I need to do is pull her in the front seat and nurse her right there in the cold truck. But instead, I turn and beg her, please, just this once. Stop crying. Please, just stop. Please, please. She chokes on an inhale, sputters, and begins to shriek. I'm on my knees, reaching over the front seat, planning to unbuckle her, but instead I find myself clenching my fists and pounding them on the ceiling as hard as I can. Just shut up! Shut up! I scream. Outside, the moon is big and yellow and very low in the sky. I rock Stella inside my coat, rubbing her back, humming. She's finally quiet, but all I can think about is how I have to get through this night and the next, I see no end to it. The following evening, I'm on Tom's porch. Although it's common enough to request, in this cold country, a jump for a truck, I haven't been able to knock on his door until now. I can feel my heart lobbing in my chest. The air is very cold on my face and filled with a pine scent so strong it stings my sinuses. Stella is blinking slowly, letting her eyes stay shut for moments at a time. Nobody minds that I've interrupted dinner. Charlotte says she'll watch the baby, and Tom's wife winks at me, whispering that she'll watch Charlotte. This isn't the first time my truck has refused to start in the cold, I say to Tom as I hand him the flashlight and crack open the black box of jumper cables. When I pop the truck's hood, it squeaks, as it always does in sub-zero weather. Tom reaches for the cables, but I hug them to my chest. You don't think I know my way around an engine, I say? The truth is, I don't know much beyond jumping a battery, but I like saying the words. They make me feel competent. Taking hold of the thick clamps, I squeeze negative to negative, positive to positive, the heavy metal biting into the nubs of the battery's terminals. The thrill of the truck rumbling to life is quickly deflated by the thought of Tom leaving me. Okay, I guess you're all set, he says, unclamping the cables and packing them back into the box. I move closer to him, between the exposed engines. He smiles quickly and turns, slamming closed his front hood. I take another step as a blue sedan moves slowly over the icy street. Past first my house, then his. We are so close now that the steam of our breath collides. We better get back, he says. And he blows into his hands and then lifts his chin to glance down the block. I wait for him to look at me, but he doesn't. He blows into his hands again. It occurs to me then that all of those beautiful lines of kindness could just as well have been carved by sadness, by opportunities he let slip away. I pull him to me and embrace him. It isn't at all what I'd imagined. He hugs me, but just for a moment, before he's pivoting backward from foot to foot, pulling away. I don't let go, not even when he whispers, I'm sorry. I continue pressing myself against him until I feel an ache in my breasts, the milk letting down. Tonight I can't sleep. Stella's in bed with me, and as I watch her lungs fill with air and exhale, little puffs of breath still sweet from nursing. Sliding my hand down her body, I am aware of how very small she is. This is it, I think. This is all there is to her. I stare up at the prayer flags draped from the ceiling, my eyes shifting through the sequence of colors. Lung Ta, that's what the locals called them. Wind horse. You're supposed to hang them from rooftops or bridges or mountain summits, anywhere the wind can hit them and free the prayers. But they ended up here in the stillness of our room, decorations. I can't stare at them any longer. Taking hold of the stiff cotton, I rip the sets from the ceiling. They drop lightly across the bed, the baby. I drag the strings of the prayers down the steps, into the kitchen, and prepare to bunch them into the garbage. I'm tired. I'm so very tired. Out the window, I see the snow coming fast and hard now. When I look back to the beautiful colored squares in my hands, I know that what I'm doing is wrong. I throw open the front door. With the snow, the cold snap has broken. Wearing nothing but a t-shirt and underwear, I tie off a half hitch on the porch railing and stretch the prayer flags to the slender trunk of a young birch tree. I place them as high as my arms can reach.
We now take our theme of endurance to the Kenai Peninsula, where writer Kirsha Hughes Scandies has set her protagonist working in a rural convenience store. She endures the job, her co-workers, the death of her cousin, and the heartache of being young and feeling lost. Allison Holdkamp reads an abridged version of this piece titled Closing Shift.
It's summer in the Great Land. The billboard's new lettering enthusiastically shouts. Fish license, beer, rippies, it adds tactfully. They finally changed it, just in time for the flood of weekend warriors leaving the valley behind for a day or two of adventure on the Kenai. I'll sell them the booze and a fish license if they're actually here to try to catch more than a hangover that reminds them the glory days of high school are far behind them now. The rippies are for the locals. The regulars, the people that I actually have to try to be nice to because they'll be in tomorrow, the next day, every day, trying to strike it rich. As I draw close to the convenience store, there's a steady flow of traffic in and out of the dirt lot, kicking up clouds of dust that I know will cling to my clothes. Black t-shirt, black jeans, black high-top Converse. It's a scummy brown film I'll never be able to brush off completely. I feel an urge of anger mingled with embarrassment. I don't want to look like crap, but I don't care what any of these redneck rubberneckers think. I know my boss will have a snide remark about not dressing like a goth. He's right, but it's more of a silent protest that I'm here to pay rent, that I have no long-term career goals in ringing up chips and soda, that I hate knowing which brand of chewing tobacco has the best deal at the moment. I go past the glass-paned front, lift a defeated hand in acknowledgement of Suzanne's wave inside. The back is blaring country from the radio as usual, and I sling my shoulder bag over a kitchen chair with a sigh. I try to beat some of the dust off my shoulders, chest, and thighs, and give up when Bradley emerges from the office to check the fry basket he's left down. "Aren't you hot in that?" he asks with a frown, eyes on the fry basket he's shaking sizzling droplets from as he tosses its contents and then resubmerges it in the hot pool of grease. I shrug, even though I know he's not looking at me. I am simultaneously attracted to and utterly repelled by Bradley. Well, that makes it sound like more than it is. Too dramatic. I'm utterly repelled by every aspect of Bradley, except when I see him, I want to make violent, passionate love to him. He's not even that good looking. Dirty blonde, tan so deep it looks like he needs a shower, too skinny. But you can tell he's tough as nails. At least he's tall. That's something I can barely admit to myself, but I feel my cheeks flushing hot. I try to stay turned away from him while I grab my name tag and give a futile tug to my hair in an attempt to corral any flyaways that make me look even sweatier and messier than I really am. Up front, Suzanne squeezed herself into another sundress from Walmart's junior section. She has the same station twanging away on the little boombox under the counter. At least with tourists, my shift will pass quickly. It's a nonstop stream of requests for ID, for cigarettes, for licenses, and for handfuls of the stale grease bombs Bradley brings out in a tray from time to time, restocking the cabinet at my elbow. Each time he does, Suzanne shouts a thank you. He's right next to me when he replies, so it feels like he's speaking to me every time he grunts out, "You're welcome," before returning back to kill time. The kitchen closes a couple of hours before the store proper, so as traffic slows down, Bradley makes sure everything is off, everything perishable is refrigerated, and he reclaims whatever's left in the case for his dinner. He probably sweats vegetable oil, I tell myself. It doesn't help. After he's gone, it's just me and Suzanne, and I count the minutes before she makes her big play to get me to take care of all the trash for her. She never does it if she can help it. I don't mind. It means I don't have to deal with any customers, so I pull a couple of heavy-duty bags from the box by the door and head out before she can even finish telling me about her bum knee. I get a breath of the cool air wafting in off the water, with the sun hanging low and hazy over the Aleutians. The sky above me is a wash of deepening blue, the clouds picked out in bright salmon pinks and oranges as they catch the rays of the slowly setting sun. After loitering by the trash can as long as I can, I head back in to make sure the shelves look okay and there aren't any large sums of money missing from my cash drawer. I grab my bag and a pack of Marlboros that I dutifully write up in my employee account under Suzanne's watchful eye. They trust her with the key to lock up, not me. I'm glad. All I have weighing me down is the fact that I'm still here. Still smiling and grabbing a two-pack of Kodiak for guys who seem to pledge half their paycheck to new fox racing gear. I start retracing my steps for the walk back to my aunt's house on the same path as earlier. I like walking against the traffic because that way I'll see any funny business before it hits me and smashes all my bones into powder. But right now, all the inbound traffic has dried up. Now it's a steady stream of people headed out to the bars. Later, they'll still return, a little more erratic, a little bit slower reaction time, a little more weaving as they head back this way to pass out in each other's bedrooms. Clear out before any husbands get home from the slope. A truck slows opposite me, and I keep my eyes locked on the four-wheeler trail in front of me until I hear my name. Startled, I look up and see Bradley leaning forward from the passenger seat, looking across the bored driver who couldn't care less whether I get a ride or walk until my feet are bloody stumps. I cross the road as much because I don't want to deal with them getting rear-ended by any pre-gamers heading out to party, as because I have no idea how to respond to Bradley's drawl outside of work. He hops out and flips the seat forward, offering me the little side saddle jump seat in back. I knew I hated him. I crawl up and in, and he flips the bench seat back, hopping up in a way that makes me think that he pictures mounting a steer in a rodeo arena when he does it. "Where are you headed?" he asks, as if I have a life and plans and I'm going somewhere right now. "Just home," I mumble. There's a silence, and I realize that I'm supposed to ask what they're doing. So I do. "Catch a few hoes at the slide," the driver laughs. I'm repulsed, more by the whole scene than his specific goal, but I don't say anything. "Just trying to get messed up," Bradley says and glances back at me. I can't picture myself enduring the loud, tinny dance music, the meat market on the dance floor. And I shake my head reluctantly. If only they were doing anything else, I would try to play along for the novelty. "I have to make sure everything's okay at the house," I say, a total cop-out. "Your aunts?" Now I'm really, truly shocked. It's not that Bradley couldn't have overheard that detail when any of the kindly, well-meaning older ladies grill me at work, but I didn't expect him to be listening. I just nod and reply, "That was your cousin, right?" I see grilling isn't limited to the old biddies who pick up Mary Kay money at the store, and my stomach clenches. Yeah. Shotgun. It's not a question. Yep. Although I try not to spend any time dwelling on the details, I feel tears rising to my eyes and I have to swallow hard. Thank God my aunt doesn't try to bring it up to me yet, just cries in her bedroom. Did my cousin swallow hard before he pulled the trigger? Take a last breath? Blink? Hardcore, the driver mumbles. And quick as that, Bradley's arm flashes as he slugs the guy's ribs. There's a momentary bobble, the truck nodges right in response, and the rest of the ride is silence until the truck stops at the driveway for my aunt's trailer. Bradley hops down, pops the seat latch to let me out. As I climb, he asks, "You want company?" I know my aunt's asleep. Oh, that means she's sprawled out on the couch, the television whispering deals at her subconscious. No, there's nothing else for me to do except feel sorry for myself holed up in my haunted bedroom. Nod. He grabs an open case of beer from the floor and slaps the passenger seat. "Text me," he croaks to the driver, who doesn't ask questions, just pulls back onto the highway once the door is shut. After an awkward pause, he heaves the case to a better grip and we start down the driveway, gravel shifting and occasionally crackling under feet. I'm running through what to say to keep him from trying to come in the trailer, but he doesn't even try to follow me up the porch stairs. I enter, drop my bag near the door, shut the television off. I know my aunt will shuffle off to her bedroom the next time she nods awake and realizes the infomercials are gone. I take a second look at myself in the hall mirror. I don't know how anyone sees anything but the eyes staring wide, demanding to know how any of this is real. Blue circles underneath. I can't tell what I look like. Am I cute? I have no idea. I have a nose, a mouth. Nothing too far out of the ordinary. But I can't find it in me to worry about mascara or lip gloss these days. I sigh and head back outside to see what Bradley's doing in my yard. He's cracked a beer, leaning against the porch and looking out at the creek that runs a couple of hundred feet away. I shut the green screen door quietly and descend the steps to the yard, nonchalantly following his line of sight as I settle near, but not too near. He hands me a beer and we gaze into the quiet evening. "Lot of fish?" he asks, nodding toward the creek. I shrug. But it's different than earlier today, I guess. I don't actually fish. I'm a vegetarian. That's why there's always beef burritos left at night. I snort, giggle. Don't know how to say that the reason there's anything left for him at night is that a small fraction of our clientele have taste. He throws an arm around my shoulder like it's no big deal. It probably isn't for him catching hoes nightly in town. I take a deep breath, and before I can think what to say, his face is descending. His lips are warm, A minute? A few minutes? Half an hour? I'm ashamed, but all I can think about is his mullet and how ridiculous it is this whole time while he's earnestly trying to summon some kind of normal response. I smile once he gives up and we resurface, but I can tell it looks as apologetic as I feel. He drains his beer, crushes the can, drops it in the box, and starts to pick the case up, then sets it back down. He checks his phone, texting. I feel a stab of wistful jealousy. I wish that he didn't want to text someone else within 30 seconds of kissing me, but I know that I don't give him any reason not to. I'm watching his face. Faint glow from the phone screen reflecting on him as the light starts to fade here behind the tree line. I think about Evan, whose bedroom I'm living in, telling me that he didn't feel anything unless he was drunk or he had pills or both, and I fish another beer out of the case, keeping my eyes on Bradley. He glances up, but it's kindly, if anything. It makes me feel hot prickles in my eyes again. I look away as I crack another beer and drain half of it in one go. "You want me to leave the case?" he asks, finalizing his plans to bail out for somewhere more fun. I think how icy and cool I would be if I kept my eyes on the silty stream as I nod. But I can't. I have to glance back at him to judge his mood. He's watching me, a kindness or pity in his eyes. Oh, my stomach churns. Didn't this guy revolt me? Here's the proof. I want to vomit when I watch him feel sorry for me. I blink back more tears and nod with an involuntary sniffle. It makes him smooth my hair back behind one ear. I want to think it's romantic, sweet, but I feel like a 5-year-old getting patted on the head. His phone chirps, and after glancing at it, he gives me an awkward hug that makes me understand there will be no more midnight kisses between us and starts back up the driveway. I hoist myself on the deck built in front of the trailer door, finish my beer, crush it, and pull the next one out of the case.
Our last story this evening is by Joe Carson. Joe takes us to the Deep South in 1962, where we follow a young man from the North enduring the trials and lessons of a date with the Southern Belle. Sweet Sunny South is read by Ryan Conero.
Samantha and I lie on the beach. We are in the deepest possible South with its sneaky, brutal sun. This is not the sun I expected. I'd pictured the big yellow ball in a child's drawing, the sun of a perfect sunny-side-up egg smiling down from the blue sky on honeysuckle, hummingbirds, and Uncle Remus. The Gulf sky is seldom blue. The sun is everywhere but unseen, hiding in the haze, working me over. I imagine that it's punishing me for being so awkward, for not knowing the local ways, the slow and easy style. It's July 1962, and I've just celebrated my birthday. I'm now 17, I'm a Yankee, and a semi-virgin. I thought it would be simple. One day you're a virgin, and the next day you're not. My problem is that my first attempts at sex were so clumsy that I'm not sure they really counted. In a way, I hope they didn't. If my accomplishments in bed to this point were the real thing, then I figure the whole business is highly overrated. Still, a man is supposed to keep score. Nothing, it seems, is simple anymore. I watch Samantha, perfectly still on her towel. The blasting heat does not bother her. It wouldn't dare. Samantha is a genuine Southern belle, and even the elements must show a proper respect. The gorilla sun kneads and pounds my belly. It tears the skin from my shoulders, but only touches the few golden hairs sparkling over Samantha's rich tan. There's a little moisture on her upper lip. I'm soaked. Bells, of course, know the secret to not sweating. It's part of the education, along with holding quarters in your armpits at the dinner table so you can't reach for what you should be served, or learning to smile right into the eyes of a man who, when he helps you in or out of a car, to distract him from sneaking a look at your legs. Even a gentleman, and bells associate only with gentlemen, will sometimes succumb to this temptation. Samantha has explained these things to me, and I'm fascinated. I thought bells were just born that way. I know nothing. Samantha has also had lessons in music, posture, dancing, and even kissing. Kissing lessons? If northern girls receive such thorough training, I wouldn't be suffering with this uncertainty about the status of my manhood. Finally, I'm in good hands. We wheel into the Dixie Queen drive-in in my borrowed Lincoln Continental convertible, pure class. The car belongs to Lucky, whose real name is Leon, a distant cousin I've been staying with. Relatives in the north had told me to look up Leon. No one knew anything about him, but he was blood, no matter how diluted, and I was assured that he would be hospitable. Lucky has turned out to be a gambler and a minor hoodlum who wears silk suits and pointed black and white shoes with wooden heels. I like Lucky. He's capable of making the big gesture, so tonight we have the Continental. Among the Continental's many amazing features is the ability of the front seat to fold completely backwards so that the car can be turned into a plush open-air bed. This is done electrically, like raising and lowering the windows. You just push a button. Lucky has explained about the bed in great detail, and I promised him that I'd put it to good use. Lucky's 10 years older than me, and he's very concerned about my sex life. It seems like all the older men who I meet are. Samantha loves the car. She sits close, right up against me. When I drove Lucky's Chevy, she never sat that close. As soon as I park, Samantha removes the bubble gum from her mouth and places it in my hand. Now, the first time I was confronted with this ritual, I was ready to jump on the next Greyhound heading north. I was devastated. I figured I'd strayed too far. I entered a territory too alien for my survival. Was this a local gesture of acceptance or rejection? Was there a gum shortage? Did a proper gentleman periodically inspect a lady's bubblegum to make sure it was still fit for her to chew? Now I'm perfectly at ease with the gum business. I actually enjoy it. According to Samantha, it's not ladylike or belle-like to dispose of one's own gum. This is a man's job, and the whole thing must be handled discreetly and without fanfare. Holding the sweet pink gum still warm from Samantha's mouth gives me a thrilling sensation of intimacy. I wait until she isn't looking, this is how it's done, and I toss the gum out the open convertible. True chivalry. I'm definitely making progress. The car hop, a black boy in his early teens, attaches a tray and hands me the menu. Samantha will have a strawberry milkshake for her dinner. She eats nothing but sweets. Ice cream, soft drinks, candy, pastry, and something she calls French breakfast, which, for all I can tell, is coffee and a donut for twice the price you pay when it's called coffee and a donut. She drinks her coffee iced and with 4 spoonfuls of sugar. The closest thing to a real meal I've ever seen Samantha eat was a plate of grits, which she smothered in honey, topped with raspberry preserves, and washed down with a Coca-Cola. I find that Samantha's unusual diet only enhances her magic. All of my life, I've been told that such eating habits would lead to ruin. Samantha's teeth, complexion, and figure are perfection. My own constitution is rooted in the North Woods and the need to keep up with a body that continues growing each year. I order a hamburger, the biggest one they've got. When our food arrives, Samantha is still sitting so close to me that her hair rests on my shoulder. She has the usual sweet fragrance about her. Since the smell persists when we go swimming, I assume that its source is something other than perfume. Perhaps it comes from her literally being made of sugar. It's a wonderful smell. Samantha drinks her shake with dainty, well-paced sips. Amazing. Those gross beasts I used to date up north would have had the whole thing finished already and be slurping around at the bottom of the cup. Samantha must be the only person in the world who can drink a milkshake without ever slurping. My hamburger tastes awful. When I complain to Samantha, she gives me her best getting out of the car smile and tells me, "You better eat it. You could be needing some extra energy later on." This is a little more than I'm prepared for. I wonder if she picked up this sort of thing in her bell training. My guess is that she's improvising, pure Samantha, and it's very effective. I resist, possibly for the first time in my life, the temptation to say something stupid, and I say nothing. This semi-virgin with no training at all is learning. I smile back. Samantha says that she knows the food isn't very good, but there is another reason why she's insisted that we come here. This is a very special restaurant. This is the place where dances come from. Dances? Not just this town, not just this neighborhood, but right in this drive-in is where all the new dances originate. The pony, the frug, the watusi, the boogaloo. Another of Samantha's surprises. She's caught me again. I have no idea what she's talking about. I can't even fake it. It's the car hops, Samantha informs me. You give them some money and they dance for you. This is how the white teenagers learn to dance. She instructs me to give our car hop 50 cents. If I just throw the money in his direction, he'll know what to do. While I sort through some coins, Samantha suddenly bursts out with the information that she once danced with a Negro. It was at an after-hours bar and barbecue joint where the people went to hear rhythm and blues music. Now, even in these final days of the Old South, the still officially segregated Old South, this is a bold confession. No doubt about it, she's really letting loose tonight. I have got it made. I figure that even belles must occasionally give in to their desires, and for this purpose, I am very convenient. I'll be leaving at the end of the summer, but there's something else, too. Since I am not a gentleman, Southern or otherwise, a roll in the hay with me is like dancing with a Negro, or like my bungled sexual adventures up north. It won't really count. I make a good show of appearing shocked at Samantha, which she enjoys, and I toss 2 quarters onto the pavement with a sneer. Samantha presses tightly against me as the kid pockets the money and goes into his dance. He's good. He manages to move everything but his feet, the reverse of my own particular style. Well, this is the place where dances come from. It should be no surprise that it gets the best dancers. They probably have auditions. The car hop stares right at me with a big grin that says, "You couldn't do this if you tried for the rest of your life." True. I give him another sneer. With the radio turned on loud and Samantha nearly in my lap, we pull out of the restaurant in grand style. Lucky would be proud of me. The drive-in movie is immediately a setback. An Elvis Presley triple feature. 5 hours of Elvis facing me. And I have the worst case of gas in history. Now, even in a convertible, gas at the drive-in has to be a disaster. It's that hamburger. I knew the hamburger wasn't right. Samantha loves Elvis, the only thing that brings her down to the level of the other girls I've dated. When the first movie begins, she leans forward and rests her chin on the dashboard, pure concentration. How will I survive this? I have to get out of the car, fast. I tell Samantha that I'm going for popcorn, and I take off at a run. When I return with the popcorn, milk duds, and juji fruits, Samantha hasn't moved. She reaches for the candy without looking. Her hand is apparently an antenna for sweets. I bound from the convertible again. Standing beyond the last row of cars, I wait for relief. People must be wondering about me. They probably think I'm a pervert, a peeping Tom. Everyone knows that it's out in the last rows where all the heavy action takes place. That car hop would enjoy this. I'm inventing a new dance. Maybe he poisoned me. I head back to the Continental with a Coke for Samantha. She finally turns her attention from the screen to take the drink, and she tells me that it's no wonder you Yankees are always complaining about the heat. Why can't you learn to be steel? I love the way she says the word still, stretching it into 2 syllables. Samantha begins filling me in on the plot while I grip the edge of the seat. Fortunately, we're running low on candy. I hope Samantha's hungry tonight. 3/4 of the way through the last feature, I have recovered from my hamburger to the point that I can be steel. Samantha has consumed enough candy to send every dentist in Mobile, Alabama to the mountains for the summer, and enough Elvis to sit back with her head on my shoulder. She gives me a new smile, one I haven't seen before. The big fat sun I could never find in the southern skies is in that smile. One final bad guy to be punched, a final song to be crooned, and we'll be out on the back roads with the tall pines and the chew mail pouch barns looking for the just right spot. I've practiced finding Lucky's magic button in the dark, and I can do it with either hand. I hold Samantha gently. A warm, sweet wind is blowing in from the Gulf. It's sweeter than Samantha's one long dessert, sweeter than all the azalea blossoms, the low tide gumbo, the mint juleps, and the Coca-Cola, and the whole sweet, sunny South.
Well, that's all we have time for this evening. So thank you, writers. And thank you, actors, so much. Thank you. Very much. And thank you, audience, for participating in Arts at 360's Writers Showcase. For extended biographies and links to our writers and actors' webpages, and to rewatch the program, please go to 360north.org. Good night.